Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Dan Kennedy, a professor of journalism at Northeastern University, who we spoke with some months ago when he wrote an article warning progressives to be careful what they wish for in wanting one of the less electable Republicans to get the nomination instead of the more competent Romney. Now that Romney seems likely to be the nominee, we'll examine the candidate and how he might handle the challenges ahead. Then we'll look further at the Republican frontrunner with Glenn Johnson, who is the politics editor at the Boston Globe's online component Boston.com and the lead blogger for the site's blog, Political Intelligence. He covered Romney's 2008 campaign and is covering the current one, and we will discuss the candidate and his likely campaign themes that were outlined in his victory speech in New Hampshire. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK's Guardian newspaper. We'll get an update on the health of Hugo Chavez and a local perspective on the visit by Iranian President Ahmadinejad, who also joined Hugo Chavez for the presidential inauguration of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. Joining us now is Dan Kennedy, a professor of journalism at Northeastern University, specializing in new media trends. He is a regular panelist on WGBH Boston's Beat the Press, and his blog Media Nation tracks issues related to journalism, politics, and culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Kennedy.
Thank you, Ian.
And when we last spoke, we spoke about an article you'd written warning progressives to be careful what they wish for in wanting one of the less electable Republicans, like Herman Cain, I think who was the front runner at the time, to get nominated instead of the more competent Romney. And the theory behind that was that you thought that it was better to have somebody that was actually a little qualified to be the president if indeed outside conditions got so bad that any Republican would be electable. That's a pretty good paraphrase, is it not?
Yes, that's exactly what I wrote.
Well, it would seem to me that, regrettably, that scenario is becoming much, much more real, in as much as we have a Cold War with Iran that is likely to get hot. And a lot of analysts think that sometime this year Israel will strike Iran. At the very least, these naval exercises that the Iranians are conducting along with the joint U.S.-Israeli exercise at the same time and in the same waters is likely to spark something. There's also a theory out there that Netanyahu, who's close to the Republicans, might want to help them. So that's just one of the shoes that could drop. And, of course, the other shoe that could drop is the euro could crash because, for reasons that still mystify me, the Europeans seem incapable of getting their hands around the euro crisis, and it's still smoldering away.
Well, indeed it is. And I think that more than anything, it's the economy that could still end up defeating President Obama as he seeks re-election. Probably not Iran, because regardless of what happens with Iran, I think that there's kind of a rally around the president effect whenever there's any sort of foreign crisis in the works. But certainly the economy is a huge ongoing threat to Obama's hopes for a second term.
But what happens if, for example, Israel attacks Iran, which the president and the Joint Chiefs and every senior American official, including Panetta, have been privately telling them not to do? If he was in a situation where he didn't want to support a situation and the price of gas would go through the roof, this could be a complete catastrophe for Obama, couldn't it?
Well, it could. And I mean, I think you put your finger on it. I think the price of gas going through the roof is what would have more of an effect on him than any of the particulars of a military situation with Iran.
I didn't mean to interrupt that, Dan, but that was the reason why the president opposed the Defense Authorization Act, that the Republicans inserted language in there about putting the squeeze on Iran that he felt would, in fact, tie his hand and drive up the price of oil.
No, absolutely. And I mean, you know, not only that, but under the Constitution, the president is supposed to have a fairly free hand when it comes to the conduct of foreign policy. Not an entirely free hand, but for Congress to be trying to dictate specific policies with regard to international affairs is in itself problematic.
So, Dan Kennedy, given that, we can't declare Romney the winner already because the knives are out in South Carolina. Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, who's close to Gingrich, and you know, Gingrich recently said that the Palestinians are an invented people, which was music to Adelson's ears, and he's now dropped $5 million into a super PAC for Gingrich. And Gingrich, both Gingrich and Perry are down in South Carolina referring to Romney as a vulture capitalist. And there's an expensive, I think, 27-minute film that Gingrich has produced and is airing down there that just eviscerates Romney. All this is happening in spite of the fact that Romney, in his acceptance speech, accused President Obama of wanting to put free enterprise on trial. It looks like it's the Republican candidates who are putting free enterprise on trial.
That's right, and in his speech last night, a remarkably cynical and dishonest speech in many respects. But in his speech, Romney also said, not only is Obama attacking my ties to the free enterprise system, but so are fellow Republicans, and it's just shocking that they would do such a thing. The problem is, I mean, what we're finding is that Romney, his opponents aren't just weak; he's practically unopposed. These other candidates are just not ready for the big stage, and they just prove it over and over again. And moreover, as they head to South Carolina, none of them will get out of the race. So they keep whatever anti-Romney vote there is, and there does seem to be a considerable anti-Romney vote if only an alternative would emerge. It just ends up continuing to get split, three, four, five different ways.
So, Dan Kennedy, you mentioned Romney's acceptance speech in New Hampshire, or his victory speech, I guess. It struck me that when he keeps talking about Obama being a socialist and looking for guidance from European capitals, not from Main Street USA, that he's inventing an Obama, and most of his campaign ads against Obama have largely been inventions. In fact, one was downright dishonest in using a quote of Obama quoting John McCain, and not attributing to the remark to John McCain. So it made it sound like Obama was was critical of America. When he was being critical of McCain, being critical of America, so I get, when you say it's cynical, it seems to me that inherent in this in Romney's strategy is he's running against not against the real Obama, but a fictional Obama that he's creating. Do you think it's going to work?
Well, I don't know what Romney might have in store for the general election. I think that right now it's working on a very different level, and that is it's working in that he is sending a signal to the conservative base of the Republican Party that you can trust me, I'll do anything and say anything to appeal to you and to defeat Obama. So I really think that when he engages in this kind of ridiculous and extreme rhetoric about Obama, he's not really talking to people who he's really talking to the base of the Republican Party, and they're going to vote Republican this fall anyway. It's really more of a signaling that you know, you can stop looking at the Newt Gingriches and the Rick Santorums and the Rick Perrys. You can vote for me. I'm a safe choice. Look what I'm saying about Obama. I really think it's as simple as that.
So I suppose, in a way, given that the Republican right-wing base already believe that Obama is a Muslim without a valid birth certificate, it doesn't matter what you say, right? They'll believe anything.
That's right. They'll believe anything, absolutely. And I don't even know whether they believe it or not. What they want is they want somebody to come out and toss them large chunks of red, bloody meat. And Romney is trying to fill that need for them so that they don't feel a need to go elsewhere.
So tell me, since Romney was your governor there for a number of years in Massachusetts, again, Dan Kennedy, professor of journalism at Northeastern University and a regular panelist on WGBH Boston's Beat the Press, the conventional wisdom was that the reason he won in New Hampshire was that he was popular because he was the governor next door and had a residence there. What's the feeling in Massachusetts about their former governor, because isn't he running from everything he represented in Massachusetts?
Well, it would seem that way, wouldn't it? I mean, as governor of Massachusetts, Romney was a moderate, reasonably competent administrator of the state's affairs. I don't think that most people in Massachusetts have too much of a complaint about the way that he ran things here. To his credit, he ran a very honest administration. There was never a whiff of scandal about him. He managed a very, very difficult situation when a portion of the Big Dig, the infamous Big Dig, fell from the ceiling and killed a woman who was driving through it. He did a very good job with that. Of course, he did a terrific job with the health care law. As his sight started to turn toward national office, he became a vicious opponent of same-sex marriage when earlier in his political career he said that he would be even better for gay rights than Ted Kennedy. And also, toward the end of his time in office, he began giving speeches around the country, making fun of Massachusetts and its liberal image. So even though he did a pretty good job as governor, I think that some of his rhetoric toward the end of his time here really turned a lot of people off. And so today, he's really not all that popular in Massachusetts, and it really has more to do with what he was saying about us around the country than it does about the job he did, which for the most part was pretty good.
So, Dan Kennedy, back to your thesis some time back about why it would maybe progressives would rue the day that they wanted one of the crazier candidates like Herman Cain or Rick Perry to become the Republican president, much easier for Obama to beat, that external events or things could turn so bad that anybody could get elected, and therefore you would want a Romney because at least he's competent. His foreign policy, though, which to some extent he outlined in his his acceptance speech last night in New Hampshire, that was pretty scary. I mean, I don't know who's advising him, but he was talking about even spending more on defense, and almost quoting the Roman dictum of "Let them fear us, not like us." and he talks about war with Iran all the time at every opportunity, which is ties into what I was suggesting earlier, that that may not be a far-fetched scenario, that there will be a war with Iran.
No, it may not be. And I actually wrote a piece for the Huffington Post today about Romney's speech, which I really just found appalling on a lot of levels. And one of the things I do think that we need to be concerned about, because, you know, as you say, I thought that it would make sense for the Republicans to want the Republicans to nominate Romney because he was less extreme than some of the others. But the thing is, regardless of what Romney really believes, and at this point, who knows what he really believes? I'm not sure even he knows. Presidents are held to account for what they say during their campaigns. So in Romney's mind, he may just be in campaign mode now, and he may look at that as being very different from governing mode, kind of like the first George Bush. He kind of operated that way as well. But by the time he gets into office, if he were to win, he's made some pretty strong commitments to work to repeal the health care law that President Obama helped put through Congress, to keep shoveling more money at the military at a time when the military is very bloated and we really can't afford it. And this notion of Israel can do, the Israeli government can do no wrong, regardless of, what the Netanyahu government may wish to do. These are all things that Romney is going to have to live with once he becomes president, if he becomes president. And for that matter, there are things that we will all have to live with. And that's kind of disturbing, especially since I don't know that too many people get the sense that he's saying this for any more than the political expediency of the moment.
Well, just in closing, Dan Kennedy, what about Romney's central appeal, at least the one that he thinks is his winning suit, one presumes so, and that is that I'm a businessman. I have a proven track record in business with Bain Capital. He doesn't say I'm the exemplar of the 1%, which he is, but this other guy doesn't know what he's doing, and I'm the businessman that the country needs to get its house in order.
Well, that's a very appealing message at a time when people are scared about the economy. It's a very simplistic message. I'm not sure how being a successful businessman really translates into holding the highest elected office in the land, where the effect that you have on the economy tends to come through other tools, through taxes and spending, through various other policies. But regardless, certainly when you hear people talk about, well, why are you supporting Romney? Invariably, it's because of his business background, and he does have a very impressive business background. Of course, voters are also going to learn about companies that were destroyed and people who lost their jobs as a result of the way he pursued that business career. But for the most part, I think it's a plus, and it's going to remain a plus.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dan Kennedy.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Kennedy, a professor of journalism at Northeastern University, specializing in new media trends. He is a regular panelist on WGBH Boston's Beat the Press, and his blog, Media Nation, tracks issues related to journalism, politics, and culture. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a further look into the Republican frontrunner.
A derelict barn campaign, pretend the filthy rich to the beggar's ditch, God.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Glenn Johnson, who is the politics editor at the Boston Globe's online component, boston.com, and lead blogger for the site's blog, political intelligence. He has reported on local, state and national politics for over 25 years and covered Mitt Romney's campaign during the 2008 election and is covering the current campaign. Welcome to Background Briefing, Glenn Johnson.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Ian.
And the speech that Mitt Romney made last night, the acceptance speech or the victory speech, coming fairly early in the night since he was such a resounding winner, it seemed to lay out some of the contours for what might be his campaign themes. Did you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. I was out in Iowa last week, and it was, you know, obviously a nail-biter of a night, you know, as the vote tally seesawed back between him and Rick Santorum, and they were ready to give this exact speech last week in Des Moines. They figured that they were going to stage an upset win, that he was going to win in a state where he hadn't really competed as aggressively as 4 years ago. And they had the whole thing queued up, teleprompter all ready to go. And then as it became clear it wasn't going to be a resounding victory, if a win at all, they took that all down, and he just gave a standard stump speech. Whereas last night, the exit poll showed him winning even before the results were announced, and they were ready to go and set the narrative not only for the night but for what they hope will be the rest of the campaign.
So given that it'll be a different electorate down in South Carolina than New Hampshire, and already the knives are being sharpened, Sheldon Adelson's given Newt Gingrich over $5 million to pay back Romney for his super PACs at taking, what, 20 points out of Gingrich's hide in Iowa. And both Gingrich and Perry are talking about Romney as a vulture capitalist. I was amused to see that that in his acceptance speech last night, Romney, in attacking President Obama, said he wants to put free enterprise on trial. It looks like the other guy, his own opponents, are doing that.
Yeah, well, that was a twofold message. I mean, he even was specific enough to say even someone of our own party want to put capitalism on trial. That seems to be, you know, the response that they've settled on. But make no mistake, the viciousness of the attack in the debates over the weekend, especially Sundays, and, you know, this $3.4 million bomb or whatever it is that's about to get detonated down in South Carolina, you know, that's an issue that they're going to have to deal with. Frankly, some Republicans actually feel that it's good that it's coming out now, that this was inevitable with President Obama should he be the nominee. But there is some surprise that it's his fellow Republicans really, you know, taking, you know, this attack to him this early on this subject matter.
Well, obviously, politics doesn't have to be about the real world. It's about what you can say and what you can get away with. But it does seem that Romney is inventing an Obama that it doesn't seem to be any remotely like the real Obama, as much as he's referring to him as a socialist who gets his guidance from European capitals, not Main Street USA. And interesting enough, Obama has more problems with his own progressive base, who think he's been too soft on Wall Street and has essentially rolled over for Wall Street.
Right. Yeah, as you said, it's a narrative. You know, if it's attached to reality, it's all the better. But, you know, they've settled on this storyline. Much of that speech was standard stump that I've heard him now giving both in Iowa and New Hampshire. There was a few parts that were just, you know, a little more icing on top. But, you know, they've settled on this idea that the president, you know, is creating this welfare society, and that they're the capitalist protectors. And so, you know, the narrative and the device that they use is, you know, I want to create an opportunity society, whereas the president wants to create an entitlement society. And he wants to divide the pie, and I want to expand it. And so whether that has any bearing on reality doesn't matter. That's the thematic that they want to impose on this election right now. And that's something you can do in a vacuum. You know, he's not the nominee yet. He's still got a few more contests to go. But once he does become the nominee, there's going to be somebody that's going to specifically respond to that criticism, and that's going to be the president himself. So in a vacuum, you can make that kind of thing, and you and I can sort of question its accuracy. But once he has a real live breathing opponent, there's going to be somebody that's going to be able to answer that challenge to him.
So, again, I'm speaking with Glenn Johnson, who is the politics editor at the Boston Globe's online component, boston.com, and lead blogger for the site's blog, Political Intelligence. He's been covering Romney for a number of years, covered the 2008 campaign, and is covering the current campaign. I understand, according to a front page story in the Los Angeles Times, that Romney has developed a very advanced data mining system that allows him to target potential voters, getting reams of consumer information from them, you know, market targeting them, you know, finding out where they, what they bought at Williams-Sonoma, et cetera, puts what income bracket they are, and what magazines they subscribe to. I mean, it's all very Orwellian what's going on, but he's apparently way ahead of the pack on this one. Do you know anything more about that?
Well, no, I mean, I know Mae Reston wrote that story, and it's a very good story, but it is something that all the campaigns have gotten into now. I think that the Obama team was very proficient at this in 2008. Romney likes to, tell everybody that he likes to wallow in data, and he certainly has the finances to support this kind of activity. And so, it's not that much of a surprise that they're taking what was in 08 and taking it to the next level. In his 08 campaign, they were very sophisticated in using social media to raise money as well, something, again, that the president's campaign did quite well with his too. But, it's just always startling to read, the way that they can match public data with voter registration information and really try and identify their most vociferous and active supporters and discard those that they don't feel will be backing them. And it's a little unnerving, too, when you read how it all actually works.
So do you think, given that Romney's getting a critique from Republicans that is sort of very left-wing populist, in as much as he's a, Romney certainly is, I think, a real candidate as a one percenter. I think he probably unquestionably is a one percenter, and that, given his fortune and his Wall Street connections. Is it likely, though, that he will get a critique from the right in terms of, as opposed to the left, in terms of his business practices? Because I think there is a critique to be made that there is something wrong with this extractive capitalism that's been going on Wall Street. A number of leading economists have talked about it, that it's unsustainable. And we know that the division of wealth in this country is growing. The divide is going greater and greater. And much of Bain Capital is that extraction of wealth and the concentration at the top amongst the people who put the deals together. They walk away incredibly rich. The CEOs do well, but the company is laden with tremendous debts that they have to pay off for these leverage buyout deals to happen in the first place. So there's something inherently unhealthy about it, I think, from a capitalist point of view.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the private equity leveraged buyout side of it. You know, Mitt Romney and his supporters always talk about the venture capital angel financing, the support for the business being built in somebody's garage. That's the one that they talk about. They don't talk about the AMPADs where they went in there and charged huge fees, ran up huge debts, and eventually the company went bankrupt. They talk about the Staples and the Bright Horizons, places where they provided a little bit of seed money, and those companies went on their own and built themselves up. So, you're seeing that split already in the Republican intelligentsia right now. As this Romney issue gets debated, there's some people, Rush Limbaugh on down, who are just seething at Newt Gingrich, feeling that he's just doing the president's work for him. By dropping this kind of money bomb on Romney and running this half-hour ad against him and complaining and highlighting about all the bad side of the Bain investment portfolio. And then you get other people who, Wall Street Journal editorial page yesterday, that are talking about how this really is, the way capitalist society works, and Romney, had helped not only create jobs but improve the operation of the economy by weaning out these bad companies and building up the ones that could be saved. And so you know, I guess it's just, you know, where you come down on this. You know, in some ways it sets up tough for the Republicans heading into a general election should Romney be the nominee, because it's going to dovetail perfectly with the message being espoused nationally by the president and here locally in Massachusetts by Elizabeth Warren, most likely, that they are the ones fighting for the middle class and the Republican candidates are the ones fighting for the 1%.
Well, I must say, every time Romney tries to be a regular guy, he just flubs it you know, painfully.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, his kids, I talk to them about this a lot, and they're always telling me, regaling me with stories about what a practical joker he is. And then, you know, when you're on the rope line with him or following him around, you know, he'll just make the most awkward comments. And I don't know if it's jitters, you know, if it really is that he doesn't have that personal warmth or what, but sometimes he falls back on really curious devices. He'll just walk up to somebody and try and guess their age. And, you know, he's walked up to people. One of our reporters was standing with him. He walked up to two people sitting in a diner booth together, and he said, "Are you two together?" You know, I mean, they were sitting in two people in a two-seat booth, and he asked if they were together. It was just this kind of nervous tick.
I guess they were of a different sex, right?
Yes. I think he just felt like he should say something, but didn't quite know what to say. And so it does become a challenge for him, and that will be an issue. You know, I've covered enough campaigns now that you see that personal connection, if not dispositive of the outcome, is definitely an important part of it.
So when he kept repeating in Iowa, America the Beautiful, amber waves of grain, you know,
right.
I mean, it just seems incredibly corny, but maybe the guy is, you know, he's very square, isn't he?
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, I actually was talking to some of his advisors about it. And, you know, there's like the people here know his stump speech. They know the broad brushstrokes of what he stands for, and they want to feel good. And so they're giving them what they think they want, and that's this, you know, God Bless America themed campaign speech. You know, it's more part of the narrative than it is a part of anything else. But, you know, he likes to talk about, you know, this very red, white, and blue country, and you know, I don't think anybody denies any of that. But he seems to feel that the audience likes it, and he does get a decent response out there. It's funny to see some of the subsequent reporting. You know, I mean, who wrote some of these verses that he quotes? You know, who's behind the poetry of it? It's not necessarily people that he would think have been the authors of it.
So you mentioned these five sons who appear on stage, and they're a pretty handsome bunch of young men. Does he have a daughter?
No. He's got the five boys. He married young, met his wife when she was especially young. She was only 15 when they first started going out. And then his father, George, really took her under his wing and helped her convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, all while Mitt was overseas as a Mormon mission. And then they had these sons, starting with Taggart, the oldest, while Mitt was at Harvard in business and law school. And, you know, now each of the boys is married, and they're up to 16 grandkids. So it's really, you know, I think half the stage is usually just his family.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and hopefully we can stay in touch. It looks like he'll be the nominee, and there'll be a lot more to talk about in the coming year.
Yeah, for sure. I think this election will come into focus in fairly short order here. And then it's going to be a long general election campaign from that point on.
Well, thanks a lot, Glenn Johnson.
Anytime, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Glenn Johnson, who is the politics editor at the Boston Globe's online component, boston.com, and lead blogger for the site's blog, Political Intelligence. He has reported on local, state, and national politics for over 25 years and covered Mitt Romney's campaign during the 2008 election and is covering the current campaign. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll come back and go to Caracas, Venezuela to get an update on Hugo Chavez and the visit by Iranian President Ahmadinejad. This is a cold war. You better know what you're fighting for. This is a cold war. You better know what you're fighting for. This is a cold war. Do you know what you're fighting for? Bring wings to the weak and bring great. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Thank you.
And there has just been a state visit by the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad. He went on to the inauguration of Daniel Ortega in Managua, and now I believe he's in Cuba. And, of course, we just learned today that another nuclear scientist has been assassinated by a magnetic bomb in the traffic in Tehran. First of all, Virginia, what was the local reaction to Ahmadinejad's state visit?
Well, because of the time that it was taking place and all of the circumstances surrounding it, some of the analysts that I spoke to were quite concerned and thought that it was a very sort of, you know, overt provocation on the part of Ahmadinejad. And of course, Chavez was, you know, being so welcoming of him at a time when it seemed so provocative, that, you know, it was received with a lot of reluctance, I guess. It was just, the timing, like I said, was just less than favorable. I'm not sure if you've heard this, but the general consul of Venezuela in Miami was expelled over the weekend for alleged ties with Cuban and Iranian agents that were being accused of a cyber attack or of planning a cyber attack in several U.S. government offices. So there's been a lot of this sort of diplomatic annoyances between the U.S. and Venezuela.
Well, there's no question, I think, Virginia Lopez, that the United States and Iran are in a cold war, which could get hotter as naval exercises get underway next month. Iranians are exercising in the Straits of Hormuz, as are a joint U.S.-Israeli exercise. So do they want to be a part of this cold war?
No, I don't think so. I think that that Venezuela, or I should say that the relationship between Venezuela and Iran after Chavez came to power has always been rather opaque, and it's been mainly between the two leaders, not necessarily between the institutions of both countries. And I think it's more of for Venezuela, it's more probably trying to gain leverage within the OPEP. But I don't see Venezuela at all getting involved in military actions. I think it just would be terribly uncharacteristic of the country.
Well, I wasn't thinking so much of military involvement, but so much as, you know, the purpose of at least the Iranian news agency, when Ahmadinejad departed from Tehran, talked about international solidarity by the anti-colonial countries against the American Empire, to cut to the chase. So does that resonate?
Yeah, of course. And Chavez has very much served sort of as an anchor for Ahmadinejad in the region. Ahmadinejad has, I think, achieved a lot of regional support. But I think it does go to an extent. And I think, personally, I think it would be more of probably a rhetorical, support. In the past, Chavez has supported Ahmadinejad in when the UN passed sanctions against him, but again, I've always seen it as more of a rhetorical, type support. No, I don't think it goes beyond that.
So, in terms of the Venezuelan media, which I know is polarized, as is the whole country, at the time of the Green Revolution in Iran, after a fraudulent election that outraged people, they took to the streets and they were brutally suppressed by Ahmadinejad's Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and their religious militia, the Basij. What was this response locally? Because Chavez was given the Human Rights Award by the Iranians. So what was the local response at that point?
Chavez has always shown his support to Ahmadinejad. He's always been very vocally supportive, and there's loads of economic deals. And like I said, he's opened. Chavez is pretty much sort of responsible for opening up the region to Ahmadinejad. People like Evo Morales in Bolivia and even in the Castro brothers in Cuba. would have probably not welcomed Namajina had if Chavez hadn't served as a sort of as a entry point. With Nicaragua, it's slightly different because there was always sort of links between the two revolutions. So yes, there's definitely a support from the official government, from the stamp, you know, from the Chavez supporters and the Chavez institutions. And I assume that it will continue. I just, you know, it's strange because Venezuela's always been very open about these things, but then with the Chavez government, like I said, the relationship has been very opaque, and in the economic side of the relationship, the deals aren't necessarily disclosed openly. And on the diplomatic front, again, it's mainly done between the two leaders in private, and, you know, the details aren't necessarily disclosed.
Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is in Caracas, Venezuela. She covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian newspaper in the UK. Virginia, in terms of lack of transparency, of course, there's rampant rumors about the health of Hugo Chavez, and many people have predicted he was going to die at any moment. I've talked to a number of people in Venezuela who have basically been quite convinced that he was on his last legs, but he's shown up and done some marathon television appearances. What's your understanding of his health? I guess, again, it's all very secret, isn't it?
It's tremendously secretive. And again, we have nothing to go on other than what Chavez himself tells us. We've only learned about, you know, the diagnosis from him. We've not seen any medical reports. Just 3 days ago, coincided with the Ahmadinejad had visit, President Chavez said that he was cancer-free. But again, this isn't backed up by any sort of medical record, like we've seen, for example, with the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, or even with Paraguay's President Lugo. So again, it's more of this sort of cloud of uncertainty that envelops, you know, most of things related to the Venezuelan government.
And of course, you have to add to that Cristina Kirchner in Argentina, her health problems with the thyroid cancer that allegedly wasn't cancer. That was also fairly public. So again, what is the local reaction there? Are people sort of saying, you know, all the other Latin American leaders are being very clear about their health, why not you?
There's been a bit of that, but to be perfectly honest, it's a really absurd situation that I myself have struggled to get my head around. It's very hard to understand. It's the fact that he's been so secretive fuels the rumors that he seems to be so angry at or angered by. You know, things would be much easier if anybody was coming out to, like, say exactly what's going on. But the one sort of doctor who went out to give his opinion had been to leave voluntarily the country because he allegedly was being persecuted by some government officials. So again, it's been, you know, very covert and unnecessarily mysterious, in my opinion.
So what would be then, I guess there's no way to know what kind of physical shape he'll be in for the October elections, but presumably he's going to campaign for these elections, right?
That's what he said all along. The date for the election was to be originally held in December, and it was pushed forward to October. Again, with no, necessarily not a crystal clear explanation as to why. But I saw him personally, you know, as a correspondent visit, and he seemed strong. His hair is growing back. But again, how absurd is it that, you know, we have to go, you know, through our, like, personal impressions of what he looks like to give, you know, a sort of informed or actually not very informed guess at what his status is. I think very few countries would see this, the situation with the president's health.
Well, the people who really know about the president's health are the Cuban intelligence people. I understand that basically they're his personal and private security, aren't they?
Yes, both. He was operated in Cuba, apparently by a Spanish doctor, and it's all been held as sort of like a state secret. He was being attended by a group of medical doctors that came from Venezuela in the Venezuelan military hospital. But again, absolutely no information from them. Just a very brief press conference in which they said very little, following that other doctor that I just told you about when he left the country. But other than that, there's been very little information other than what Chavez himself tells the people in you know, TV programs.
So my understanding of Virginia Lopez, again, the Caracas-based journalist, covers Latin America and Venezuela for the Guardian newspaper of the United Kingdom, that during the Ahmadinejad visit, that he and Chavez joked a lot. It seemed, there seemed to be a fairly, you know, lighthearted relationship. Chavez talks about when we devils get together, they go crazy, referring to the United States. And mm-hmm. he also said that we are the axis of evil of Latin America. How is that playing?
This is a personal opinion. To me, it's wearing thin. You know, I've seen these jokes now for 13 years. At first, I suppose the novelty was quite exciting. But after 13 years, they just, you know, they're quite, like I said, they're repetitive. And, you know, in light of what was going on, both in Iran and with the General Council of like that not being addressed at all, it just seems like, you know, just not very funny, really, you know.
Well, how will this translate then in the elections? Do you think if other Venezuelans like yourself are getting tired of the routine after 13 years of this kind of personality-driven, nevertheless democratically elected leader, is the country tiring of him? And what do you make of the main opposition leader?
Chavez continues to be an incredibly charismatic leader. I think that the last poll put him at close to 53%, you know, in terms of if the elections were to be held tomorrow. He's also quite savvy at starting these sort of like cash transfer programs and you know, quite famous misiones. He's been very successful at handing out houses. Venezuela's undergoing a quite severe housing crisis. And, you know, we're benched in oil revenue. So I think that this next 10 months, we're going to probably see a lot of cash transfer programs and a lot of houses being handed out. So again, you know, he still counts with a lot of support from the popular base. There are issues that he's not addressed, and he still continues to not even give a clear answer whenever he's confronted about them, which things like insecurity, close to 67 people are killed every week in Venezuela. It's, you know, it's just astounding. Just last year it was 2011 closed. It was close to 1,900,000 people being killed throughout the whole year, you know, and that's something that is affecting everyone. But mainly, it's the victims are young men in low-income neighborhoods. So I don't know. It's a hard question. And the opposition, I think that the opposition is still quite fragmented. Primaries are to be held February 12th, and one candidate will be chosen to run. You know, they're representing the opposition, but we still don't know what the results of that will be.
So just to get the casualty figures correct from this epidemic of crime in Venezuela that you say that President Hugo Chavez has not addressed, when he's asked about it, what does he say?
Well, last Sunday in his sort of Alo Presidente program that he's been holding every Sunday, he was asked, you know, like, or he was, there was a phone call from a woman, actually a Chavez supporter, asking him for help because she was a victim of rampant crime. Her neighborhood had been, you know, hugely affected by the high rate of homicide. And you know, he, again, it was this example that has become quite trite. He blamed it on capitalism. And in a perhaps a bit more serious answer that I've heard in a while, he blamed it on alcohol and drugs. But again, there's been no regulation on either, you know, alcohol. There's been absolutely no more strict policing, serious attempt to curb drug trafficking, which is becoming more and more of a problem here. It's terrible. It's a dire situation. I think the statistics say something that one innocent gets killed every half hour. I don't know anybody who has not been affected directly by crime in Venezuela.
And did you say that, is it 19,000 were murdered last year in 2011?
Yes.
2011. Yes.
It's so serious of a situation that the government stopped publishing figures two or three years ago. So the figures that we have to go by are NGOs. But the last figure that the government gave two or three years ago was 14,000. So, you know, it's not a wild guess to, or, you know, I don't think that the NGOs are...
are off the mark, yeah. So surely then, Virginia Lopez, would not this be an issue that the opposition could run on in the presidential election, the law and order ticket?
Of course. And one of the opposition candidates that is actually higher up in the polls has been quite efficient as a governor in quelling the crime rate in the state that he's a governor for. But you know, the resources are limited. It's an upward battle, and again, one that I don't see why Chavez, with the immense revenues he's received in the last 13 years from oil, and with the incredible rate of popularity that he's enjoyed, hasn't been able to address at all. I don't know enough about this, but I don't see why the disarmament campaign has been so difficult to influence.
Well, let me ask you, Virginia Lopez, again, the correspondent in Caracas, Venezuela, for the Guardian newspaper of the United Kingdom. There's been a number of personal appeals. You've written about the judge that's been held for 2 years, Maria Lourdes Afuni, who Chavez is jailed for the last 2 years because I think she let a banker out on bail and he disappeared. He went AWOL. Various appeals have been lodged by Noam Chomsky, a very popular American academic who's very much on the left here. And one would think that he would carry some weight with Chavez. But I believe a number of appeals from Noam Chomsky pleading with Hugo Chavez have fallen on deaf ears. What's the latest on that?
She continues to be... She was moved from the jail to her house, where she's held still with measures that actually, you know, sound terribly inhumane, like no access to sunlight, and she can't speak to the media. You know, whenever she goes to the doctor, because she's actually quite ill, she has to be accompanied by like 60 National Guards. It's quite bad. It's obviously quite better than being in jail in Venezuela. You're completely right. Any appeal from Amnesty International or Noam Chomsky has gone unheard. She's still, in what I've described, quite dire situation.
Well, but apparently Sean Penn made a personal appeal to Hugo Chavez to persuade Ahmadinejad to release the American hikers. And supposedly that had quite a bit to do with Ahmadinejad finally releasing the American hikers who were held in Iran.
Yes, that's what rumors have said. Maybe Sean Penn should appeal for Judge Afuni, but I don't have access to him.
I see. Well, just in closing, Virginia Lopez, what's the latest on the arrest of the Venezuelan consul in Miami for espionage? We talked earlier about a Cold War between the U.S. and Iran, which I think is definitely getting more and more dangerous. What's the status of the Cold War between the U.S. and Hugo Chavez?
Well, first of all, she wasn't arrested. She was asked to leave. She was given.
Oh, she was kicked out, right? Yeah.
Yeah, she was given 72 hours to leave. And again, she's arrived in Venezuela. There's very little information coming out from the government. And actually, the U.S. government also wasn't too clear on what the reasons were. But apparently it has to do with a documentary, like I said, where she is linked to Cuban and Iranian agents planning to conduct cyber attacks on U.S. government offices. Well, relationships between Venezuela and the U.S. are clearly not as bad as the Iran and the U.S. But I do think that it's an electoral year for both countries, so I think pressures are meant you know, are bound to mount. And I think, I mean, it's, like I said, it's hard to know what's going to happen, which again, is quite strange to live in a country and not know what to expect from one day to the other. I think the U.S. is more tempted to look at Venezuela as a irritation rather than as a real threat. That's sort of been the comments we get here. They continue to be, you know, economic partners. Venezuela continues to sell oil to the U.S. So, you know, there's that sort of dependency on both parts. But, you know, in terms of diplomatic relationships, like I said, it's quite hard to know what's going to happen. But I imagine that a lot of it is going to depend how Chavez deals with, like you said earlier on, his support of Iran and his anti-US rhetoric.
And meanwhile, I believe he's very more and more dependent upon the Chinese for loans, isn't he?
Yes, yes.
So, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Virginia Lopez.
Of course.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian newspaper of the United Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.